Welcome back. This is Bev.
And this is Diz.
And this is...
Trigger Warning.
So we have a true crime case for you today.
Woo-woo!
And I do have some trigger warnings because name of the show, I've said it before and I'm going to say it again.
Yep.
This case involves the death of children. And there are some descriptions of injuries. Not a lot of detail, but just kind of the basic happenings. There is mention of child sexual abuse as well. Not detailed in any way, but I wanted to put that out there. So, if Kimberly Cam were still alive, she'd be coming up on her 60th birthday. Born Kimberly Starr Wren on March 14th, 1965, in New Albany, Indiana, Kim was ladylike and independent. Her parents, Frank and Janice Wren, said that she would likely be an executive now, owing to the fact that Kim liked to solve her own problems and that she listened more than she talked. Kim was a mother of two, 7-year-old Brad and 5-year-old Jillian, who went by Jill. If the events of September 28th, 2000 had never happened, Brad would be 32.
Oh, no.
Little Jill would have been 30. And they would both likely be college graduates, maybe even parents themselves. But Brad and Jill are forever their childhood selves. From the smiling pictures of two happy kids to the lines that marked their height on their grandparents' wall, there will be no new memories and no new milestones. That's because on September 28th, 2000, Kim and her two small children were murdered in the garage of their own home. David Ray Cam, Kim's husband, and Brad and Jill's dad, was left to face the unbearable loss and the accusations of guilt from both the justice system and the public. David Cam was born March 23rd, 1964. He was well-liked, played basketball and baseball, and was a good student overall. He studied criminal justice in college and decided to focus on a career path with the Indiana State Police. Kim and David met in 1988 and got married in the spring of 89. That same year, David was actually accepted into the Indiana State Police as a trooper recruit, and he ended up earning a position with the Emergency Response Unit. February 1st, 1993, Bradley Ray Cam was born. Kim was pregnant again in the summer of 1994 when David began an affair with a woman he'd met at the gym. Mm. I am not going to say the names of the women he had an affair with because this is not their story.
True.
David eventually moved out of the house that he lived in with Kim and Brad. And again, she was pregnant at the time. And he moved in with his mistress. Kim and David's parents both all supported Kim during her pregnancy. They were there for her, his parents included. And when Kim gave birth to Jillian Catherine Cam on February 28th, 1995, both sets of grandparents were there.
Aww.
The only person not there was David Cam, the dad. About a month after Jill's birth, David's affair ended, and he immediately hoped to reconcile with Kim. She did end up taking him back. Both families supported her decision despite their surprise at it. But she still loved him, and they had two small children together.
Mm-hmm.
The baby was a month old.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. So as a fresh start, David and Kim had a new home built on Lockhart Road in Georgetown, Indiana. And from all reports, David had changed when it came to his kids. Anyway, he was a loving father. He spent as much time as possible with the kids. His work with the Indiana State Police took quite a bit of time,
mm-hmm.
but he made up for his absence in their early lives as best as he could. He coached Little League. He spent as much time with them as he could and was a really good father.
Mm-hmm.
There were other affairs, though, that ended up happening again, but I guess those were kept quiet from her anyway. Anyway, in 2000, David ended up leaving the Indiana State Police and joined his uncle's basement waterproofing business. At the time, Kim was working full-time as a senior accountant at an insurance company in Louisville, Kentucky. So this is, I guess, near the border of Indiana and okay. Kentucky because mm-hmm. they're kind of they talk about Louisville a lot, and then a couple little small towns in Indiana a lot, and if you're looking through the stuff, it's kind of hard to follow, and then I realized that it must have just been, like, right on the border, where it was just, like, D.C. and Maryland, or D.C. and Virginia, where you can kind of go either way. Mm-hmm. Brad was in second grade at this time, Jill was in kindergarten, and they seem to have it all. It's that... that nuclear family, the mom and the dad and a boy and a girl and a beautiful new home. Yeah. David was actually making more money working with his uncle than he had as a state trooper.
I believe that.
Kim was a wonderful mother and working full time, and the kids were both in school and participating in extracurricular activities. So just little, like little perfect family. Nuclear family, mm-hmm. Mom, dad, two kids and a house in the suburbs.
Wow.
So, September 28th, 2000, started as a normal day, as they always do in the stories like this. Mm-hmm. Kim got up around 6 a.m. David and the kids followed shortly after. David left for work first. Kim made arrangements with her parents for later that day, and then she took the kids to school, and she continued to work after that. Around 4, Kim left work and picked up Jill for dance practice. Around 6, she took Brad to swim practice. Then around 7, she and the kids headed home. There was I can't remember how far it was, but it was like a 20-minute drive or something to get home.
Okay.
After work that day, David had gone home briefly around 6 p.m., and then at 7 p.m., he drove down to Georgetown Community Church for his weekly basketball game with friends. He played the first game, decided to sit out the second one. Some sources say that there were several games, like there was a couple brothers that played like a quick one-on-one game, and then there was like, you know, because it's like just pick-up basketball. It's like sometimes it's a couple people, sometimes it's 5 people, sometimes it's 6 people, whatever.
Yeah.
So some people say that he played like the first couple and then sat out the third or fourth. I don't know how it actually worked out.
Okay.
But he was there, he played. And then he sat on the sidelines, or, you know, was walking around on the sidelines chatting, talked to one of the church elders, watched the games. The games all ended. Everybody left around 9:20.
Okay.
And David left with everyone else. He drove 2.5 miles home. The scene in the garage would change the lives of David, his family, and Kim's families forever. Kim was on the floor of the garage, lying in a pool of blood that came from her head. Jill was still in her car seat, belted in, her blonde hair covered in blood. Brad was laying over the back seat as if he had tried to climb into the rear storage area to get away from his attacker. Brad didn't have any head wounds, and David said he still felt warm, so he reached in over the center console and pulled his son from the vehicle. He attempted CPR, but soon it was obvious that he couldn't be saved. Having left the Indiana State Police only 4 months before, David ended up calling his old post at 9:30. Instead of dialing 911 directly, he called where he actually had worked and demanded to speak to post command. Once he was connected to the post commander, he screamed, "Get everybody out here to my house now. My wife and kids are dead." And you can find recordings of this emergency call online.
Yeah.
And it is hard to listen to.
Really?
He sounded, I mean, freaked out. He screamed, "Get everybody out here now." I mean, he was freaking out.
Wow.
And they were like, "Okay, we're coming. Get everybody out here now." He was freaking out. And at one point he says, "Oh my God, what am I going to do?" And you could tell he was crying. It was... If he wasn't acting it, he deserved an Oscar.
Yeah.
It was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
So after they said they were on their way and everything, he hung up and ran across the street where his grandparents lived. He alerted them to the situation, then he returned back to his house and waited for first responders to arrive. Sean Clemens was a former colleague and a close friend, and he was one of the first responders. He did a routine interview with David, and during which time David told him, "Get it right. Ask me anything you want to ask me." During the interview, David said he saw Kim immediately upon opening the garage and screamed her name, but he could tell from her eyes that, quote, she was gone. Both Jill and Kim had been shot in the head, and when he saw that Brad didn't have a head wound, he checked and thought he was still warm. He explained that's why he attempted to help Brad but didn't try CPR on Kim or Jill.
Mm-hmm.
At first, the police considered that the deaths could have been due to a robbery gone wrong, but the evidence at the scene didn't support that theory. Kim had no pants on, and her shoes were sitting side by side on top of the Ford Bronco that she'd driven home. Her pants were laying nearby. Near where David had laid Brad when he tried CPR, there was a sweatshirt folded neatly on the ground. There were no signs of forced entry into the garage and no signs of attempted entry into the house itself. Nothing was missing from the garage or the house. So it looked like then they realized the motive was to kill Kim and the kids.
Yeah.
Since this was the case, and despite David's cooperation with his former colleagues, suspicion immediately landed on him.
Which it usually does.
Yeah, the spouse is always considered a suspect in a murder case, because unfortunately, it happens fairly
often.
Yeah. But the Indiana State Police were suspicious of him for other reasons. First, they wondered why he called his old post instead of calling 911.
Mm-hmm.
David told them that he called them because he wanted to send the best investigator, and the state police were the best. He said he wanted the best to figure out what happened and to find the person who did this. That's why he called them.
Mm-hmm.
And he trusted them. The Indiana State Police also said that in cases where someone tries to revive a victim or assist in some way, there's usually disturbances at the scene, like footprints or things knocked over or whatever. In this case, they said the scene was almost too neat. A forensic analyst also noticed a mop and bucket and a sink in the residence, which they believed was possible evidence of an attempted cleanup or tampering with the evidence.
Wow.
So, David's clothes and shoes were collected per standard operating procedure and sent to the lab for testing. Autopsies confirmed that Kim and Jill were both shot in the head. Kim had multiple bruises, but there were no signs of sexual assault, despite her pants being missing. Along with the gunshot to her head, Jill's autopsy revealed blunt force trauma to her external genital region. The medical examiner said this type of injury is consistent with sexual molestation or a, quote, straddle fall. So I guess if you think about straddling, like a fence, that means you have a leg on either side. If you fell and something was between your legs, you could hurt yourself that way. I assume even if you fell and, like, had your foot curled under you and landed on your foot, it could probably cause that problem.
Yeah. That's weird, though.
Yeah. Brad had been shot in the left shoulder. The bullet severed his spinal cord and then exited his right shoulder. And at first, both Kim and David's family supported him, and they believed there was no way he would kill his family.
Mm-hmm.
On October 1st, 2000, though, David was arrested for the murder of his wife and children. So this was like 3 days later.
I cannot even imagine that.
Yeah. And he felt betrayed because his former colleagues, he considered them family. And he could not believe that they thought he committed this crime.
Uh-huh.
But the evidence that they had, you know, only made them more suspicious. A neighbor of the Cam family had told police that she thought she heard gunshots around 9:20 to 9:30 p.m. And David was adamant that the neighbor was mistaken, because that was when he got home from the game. One expert said that the bloodstains on David's shirt were a high-velocity blood spatter, or blowback from a gunshot, suggesting that the blood had sprayed back onto David when he shot his daughter, because that blood was Jill's blood. Stan Faith, the state prosecutor, believed that David had come home from his basketball game and immediately killed his family before calling the Indiana State Police. Mr. Faith claimed that the motive for the murders was due to David's continuing adultery and his molestation of his daughter. So, David Kam, his trial started January 24th, 2002. During the trial, the timeline changed. The autopsy showed that Kim and the kids were killed earlier in the evening, likely as soon as they'd gotten home, which would have been closer to 7:30 p.m. At that time, David had been playing basketball at the church, an alibi which was corroborated by 11 people that had been at the church that night.
Uh-huh. Okay.
They were friends and stuff, including his uncle that he worked for, whose name was Sam Lockhart. The prosecutor, Stan Faith, just adjusted his story of the events and said, okay, then he snuck out of the church that evening, drove home, killed his family, and then drove back to the gym to maintain his alibi. All of this without any signs of stress and no obvious bloodstains on his clothes.
And nobody noticed him being
And
gone.
All those 11 people said, we don't remember him leaving. Like, nobody saw him leave or come back. He didn't act different.
Hey, where'd he go?
He didn't act weird. He didn't act nervous. We didn't see any stains on his clothes that showed blood.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you think there would be bloodstains.
But because of his background in law enforcement, mm-hmm. Stan Faith, the prosecutor, said that David orchestrated the entire thing to produce a fake alibi. As proof, they noted an outgoing business call made from the Cam residence at 7:19 p.m. when David was supposed to be at the church. And they know it was a business call because it was a customer of the waterproofing business that he and his uncle were involved in. However, the defense explained that the time of the call was actually 6:19 p.m. Indiana has two separate time zones.
Oh.
And the difference between the zone where the call was placed and the zone where the call connected created some confusion about the time of the call. But the phone company did confirm that the time would have been 6:19 p.m., which was around the time that David said he was home and way before Kim and the kids made it home.
Okay.
During the trial, several women gave testimony that they had had affairs with David Cam or were propositioned by him. There were, I think, 12 total.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And the prosecution presented this as motive for David to kill his family.
Okay.
So one of the most damning pieces of evidence was the high-velocity blood spatter on his shirt.
Yeah.
The prosecutor's expert had indicated that the drops of blood on David's shirt were blowback from the shot that killed his daughter, like I said. The blood expert had told the investigating officers and Stan Faith that this was the case from the beginning. He said it like the night of the killing that he made notes and said that that's what he believed it was.
Wow.
David's defense team called in their own blood spatter expert, uh-huh. Epstein, I'm not sure which way, who argued that the blood on David's shirt was not high-velocity blood spatter at all. Instead, he said the blood was consistent with David's story, that he reached past Jill when getting to his son,
uh-huh.
and her hair, which was soaked in blood, touched his shirt, which created the stains. He also said that there were only 7 or 8 small stains on David's shirt, and when it comes from a blowback from a gun, there are usually hundreds of tiny spots.
Right.
The defense team even went so far as to running t-shirts over wigs soaked in blood, and their demonstration did produce the same kinds of stains.
Okay.
Despite the evidence to the contrary, on wow. March 17th, 2002, David was found guilty of the murders and sentenced to 195 years in prison. But that was March. On August 10th, 2004.
So 2 years later.
Yeah. David's appeal was accepted and his conviction was overturned.
Wow.
The appellate court found that the testimony from the women about his infidelity should not have been allowed, mm-hmm. and that it wasn't proven to be the motive behind the murders, but it created a bias in the jury.
Right.
Because everybody wants to judge somebody for having affairs.
Right.
Even though it's probably more common.
Yeah. Okay.
So there was no real proof that that was his motive. He had never said anything to anybody about it. He'd never said, I wish I could be with my girlfriends. I wish I had never gotten married. He never said anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't find anything written or recorded or anything that he felt that way.
Right.
So the appellate court was basically like, that should never have been allowed. The testimony that these women got propositioned by him has nothing to do with the case. There's no proof that that was the motive. So, no. So they overturned his conviction. That was August of 2004. November of 2004, a new prosecutor who had just been elected, Keith Henderson, refiled the charges against David Kam.
What the heck?
So for a few months, David was free. His conviction was overturned. He was like, oh, good. Okay, great. But then the new prosecutor refiled the charges. So in 2005, David's defense team pushed to have DNA run through CODIS again from the sweatshirt that was found at the scene.
Ooh.
So this is the shirt that was on the ground near where David had laid Brad. It was folded. The shirt had the name Backbone written on the inside collar. And the state had tested the shirt for DNA at the beginning. They found two separate unknown samples, and they supposedly ran the DNA profiles through CODIS early in the investigation, but no matches came up. The defense team, again, in 2005, pushed to have it rerun again, mm-hmm. because now it's been 5 more years.
Yeah.
The prosecution refused to run the DNA again until they were forced to do so by court order.
That is ridiculous.
Yeah. So when they ran the samples this time, CODIS came up with a match.
Oh, do tell.
Mm-hmm. One of the samples belonged to a former felon, Charles Bonney, which is spelled Boney, B-O-N-E-Y, which I think is funny, but it's pronounced Bonney, but I kind of want to just call him Boney because...
But it makes me think of that sweatshirt.
Yeah. Well...
Okay, sorry.
So, Bonney had been arrested multiple times since he was a teenager, and part of his crimes involved attacking women and stealing one or both of their shoes.
Creepy.
So he was called the Shoe Bandit.
Oh, and her shoes were on the hood of the...
Yes.
Bronco.
Shoe Bandit, he was sentenced to a few months in jail for the attacks. He was ordered to pay restitution to the women for the cost of their shoes and other expenses, I guess like court fees and stuff. The fact that Bonney assaulted women to take their shoes was interesting because, as you just said, Bonney had a foot fetish and Kimberly Cam's shoes were sitting side by side on the roof of the Bronco when David Kam discovered his family.
Creepy.
Yeah. So his DNA and his sweatshirt are there. Charles Bonney was released after serving his time for the Shoe Bandit attacks. After he got out, he committed armed robberies, which landed him in prison with a 20-year sentence.
Oh my gosh.
His nickname in prison was Backbone, which was the name written on the inside collar of the sweatshirt found at the scene. And it had his DNA on it. Bonney had been released from prison just 3 months before Kim and the kids were killed. And to top it all off, his palm print was found on the Bronco.
Shut your mouth.
It's believed that he held himself up with his palm resting on the Bronco while he shot and killed Brad and Jill in the car. So, Bonney was arrested for the Kam family murders, but the new prosecutor, Keith Henderson, came up with a new theory for the crime. Obviously, David Kam and Charles Bonney did it together.
What is this guy's problem?
Yeah. So, David Kam was rearrested to face trial again. This time, he was tried alongside his alleged co-conspirator, Charles Bonney. Boney. David told investigators that he'd never met Bonney before. And at first, Bonney said the same thing. He said that he didn't know him. Eventually, he changed his story and said he'd met David Kam while playing basketball. So, the second trial for David Kam began in August 2006. He and Bonney were charged with 3 counts of murder and conspiracy to commit murder. During David's trial, an inmate named Jeremy Bullock testified that Kam had confessed to him that he'd murdered his family. He claimed that this happened that the confession happened in 2002 while they were both in protective custody in the maximum security Indiana State Prison in Michigan City. And according to Bullock, who was serving 18 years for murder, Kam was getting a tattoo over the course of about 3 weeks, and during that time, the story came out about him killing his wife and kids. And he told Bullock that he'd killed his wife and kids because of his infidelity and that there had been talk of their marriage ending. Bullock said that Kam told him he'd wished he'd had help killing them, but he didn't mention Charles Bonney or any other accomplice. He also said that David told him the sewer was a good place to get rid of a weapon, but Bullock admitted that David did not tell him that this is what he did with the gun, and the gun itself has never been found. Due to the original conviction being overturned because of the testimony about his infidelity, The prosecutors couldn't use that as motive this time. Because it would possibly lead to another turn.
Yeah.
So this time, they claim that David murdered his family when he was discovered by Kim to be molesting his 5-year-old daughter, Jill. The court allowed testimony from a friend of Kim's that they had chatted while Jim's dance practice, Jill's dance practice the day of the murders. The friend testified that they were having a casual conversation about their busy lives, and Kim told her she was expecting David to be home between 7 and 7:30 that evening. The prosecutors questioned the basketball players about this and said, "Did you know David was supposed to meet his wife at 7:30? So the prosecutors basically framed this comment as if Kim had been setting up a meeting with David to confront him about molesting Jill. Whereas it sounds like to me that she's like, yeah, he'll probably be home between 7 and 7:30. Yeah. You know, we're having steaks for dinner or whatever.
Right.
To me, it just sounds like two friends just chatting about timelines. Yeah. And, you know, it's like, yeah, after her dance practice, I got to pick Brad up and take him to swim practice and then get home. And, you know, maybe she was saying, luckily, he'll be home between 7 and 7:30. So maybe he can help the kids with homework while I do whatever, you know.
Yeah.
But the prosecutors were like, no, she was obviously going to confront him about molesting his daughter.
Have mercy.
So the medical examiner, Dr. Tracy Corey, testified that Jill's injuries could have come from sexual abuse or the straddle fall, uh-huh. like I mentioned before. Two more doctors, Spivak and Merck, both pediatricians, testified to this as well, stating that it was very likely due to sexual abuse and that it likely happened within 24 hours, but probably less than that, before Jill was killed. So, according to the prosecution, that timeline meant that only Jill's father, David, could have had the opportunity to molest her. Dr. Spivak also agreed with the prosecutor when asked if it was likely that Jill would have told her mother about the injuries and the source. So the prosecutor's like, well, don't you think she would have told her mother? And the doctor's like, yeah, likely she would have. So again, that confirmed that Kim knew, and she was going to confront David. Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
So Charles Bonet was tried separately from David, since David's lawyer successfully had his case moved to a different county
mm-hmm.
because the media coverage had been crazy.
Right.
And people in the county where it happened were biased at that point. He'd already been through trial once. The media was huge. It involved two children. So they moved it to a different county, which means that Bonet, his trial would have been set where the crime actually occurred.
Okay.
So Bonet testified in his own trial that he had gone to sell an untraceable gun to David. That was why he was at their house. He told the court that he wrapped the gun in his sweatshirt, the one that said Backbone. According to him, he'd given it to David. David approached his wife's Bronco when she pulled into the garage, and after a quick argument, David produced the gun and shot her. Then he shot his kids. So Bonet claimed that David then tried to shoot him, but the gun jammed. So he insisted he had nothing to do with killings, and basically said that he was outside of the garage and heard it happen. And he was only there to sell the illegal gun to David Cam. So, due to his right against self-incrimination, Bonet did not testify at David Cam's trial. Bonet's girlfriend at the time, whose name was Mala Singh Mattingly, I believe, did. And she claimed that when Bonet had left home the day of the killings, he told her he was, quote, going to go help out a friend. Mala's DNA was the other sample that was found on Bonet's sweatshirt, by the way. The judge ended up dismissing the conspiracy charge, but the jury convicted David for a second time for the murders of his family, and he was again sentenced to life in prison without parole. It's also worth noting that the prosecutor of the second trial, Keith Henderson, had begun the process of publishing a book about the case before the trial was even over. He and his co-writer had both received advances on the book before David was even convicted. And when David's team appealed this conviction and, spoiler alert, got the conviction reversed again. Mm-hmm. Henderson and the co-writer returned the advance checks and canceled the contract for the book.
Oh, so interesting. Yeah.
So he was planning on doing it, and then they appealed, and when the appeal went through and the thing was reversed, he was like, well, crap, I'm the prosecutor. It's a conflict of interest if I publish a book and we don't even know the story hasn't ended now.
Yeah.
I guess he didn't think it was a conflict of interest when he was, you know, prosecuting the case. But the court did decide that there was a conflict of interest for Henderson. And despite the cancellation of the contract, due to his personal interest in the case, because he also was like, I'm going to get this guy. He was no longer objective, and he was like, I'm going to get him. So David's team requested a special prosecutor, and that was granted, which meant that that Henderson could not represent the state of Indiana in David's third trial. So,
gosh, third trial. Can you believe it?
I know. The reversal of David's conviction did not mean he was free. It simply meant that he would be forced to undergo another trial for the murders. So it was basically like a reversal or an overturning of the conviction with remand for trial, which means for another trial.
Oh my gosh. So, it's a do-over.
Yeah, basically. It's like, okay, we're going to throw this one out and just do it all again.
You're still locked up, friend.
Yeah.
Okay.
There were a couple of points in the appeal that the judges dismissed when his team, you know, appealed the conviction. First, his team had wanted to include Bonet's history of attacking women for their shoes, and they had refused that in the trial, in the second trial.
Right.
They said they could not bring up his criminal history. And the judges in the appeals court said, yeah, they were right. You can't talk about his criminal history. Yeah. It's prejudiced. It's biased. And then Bonet had commented to other inmates that he had, quote, three bodies on his conscience. And they had said that they couldn't include that information either. I guess that was considered hearsay or something, but they wouldn't let that go into the court. And the appeals judges, like I said, both of those things, they were like, yeah, they were correct and not allowing that. Then David's attorneys argued that the prosecutor's blood spatter expert should not have been allowed to demonstrate the murder scene by setting up chairs in the courtroom. So the blood spatter expert had set like four chairs lined up like the Bronco would have been.
Okay.
And explained where everybody was and like where the blood spatter was and stuff like that. So they had said that the demonstration was speculation about it, how it could have occurred, but it wasn't proof. It wasn't like solid evidence. No, yeah, it wasn't concrete.
How it happened.
The appellate court, though, said that the demonstration was legal as it assisted the jury members in visualizing the scene in 3D, essentially. Since
that.
they had pictures of the inside of the Bronco. They had pictures of the victims. They had pictures of the blood spatter. So they were like, this way it just shows it in 3D where the stuff was.
I mean, I do get that because they literally do that in, not necessarily in 3D in the actual courtroom, but like on a PowerPoint type thing or something.
And they'd taken people to the scene of a crime before to show them. So so they said it was legal and it was fine. So this time the reversal was actually due to a couple different things. First, admission of hearsay evidence when Kim's friend testified that Kim said she was expecting David home by 7:30. They said that was hearsay. Because the friend said that, basically they told the defense team that if Kim had said, I'm expecting to be home by 7:30, then that's fine. Because it was just intent of her behavior.
Herself.
Her plan. Yeah. But because she told her friend that she was expecting David home between 7 and 7:30, it's considered hearsay.
Because if she was possibly expect, doesn't mean he would be home at that
time. Yeah. Okay. So So, as I talked about before, and that testimony came across as evidence that David knew he was being confronted by his wife about molesting Jill. So, they said, no, that was hearsay, so that should never have been there. And the appellate court agreed. The second reason for the reversal and retrial was because of the speculative evidence that Cam had molested his daughter. So, according to Cam's lawyers, the inclusion of this quote-unquote evidence prejudiced the jury against him. And basically, when they were saying this, there was no evidence that he was the one that molested her. The appeals court said, and I actually found the document of the appeals court their decision. Mm-hmm. It says this is kind of paraphrasing, but the jury somewhat unusually held a press conference after the defendant's sentencing. A news article reporting on the conference, the headline said, quote, "The jurors speak, molestation evidence led to guilty verdict." So basically the article says that the entire, like most of the reason why they said he was guilty was because they believed he molested Jill, but there was no evidence of that. There was no solid proof that he was the one that had done it, if it had even been done. Because she could have also fallen.
Right.
She was in dance.
She was in dance, yeah.
And so the article said that the jury said that the defendant was the only person who could have molested his daughter in the 2 days before her murder. So again, that comment that one of the pediatricians had said that was she was likely molested, you know, within 24 hours prior to the murder was like, okay, as far as timeline, he was the only one that had the opportunity. But apparently there was no evidence that that was the case either.
She's in school. She's in dance.
Yeah. I'm like, she doesn't have recess. She's in kindergarten. Kindergartners get recess.
Like, that's crazy.
Yeah. So, since they could present no solid evidence that his daughter had definitely been molested and that David had definitely done it, they should not have used this as a reason for the murders.
Mm-hmm.
So, between that and that hearsay testimony about what time he was going to be home, that's why they overturned it.
Okay.
And so, there was a bunch of other legalese I didn't really understand. So, I'm not going into that. But basically, David's attorneys argued that the evidence showed circular reasoning. This is what they were kind of saying is, the defendant was probably the killer, so he probably was the molester, so he probably was the killer. So the defense is like, you can't use that as reasoning that he killed her because he molested her, but he molested her because he killed her because but she was molested and that's why he had to kill her. So it was like a big circle and it didn't.
Yeah.
So ultimately they issued the reversal and remand for another trial.
So this is number four?
Yeah. No, this is the third trial now.
This is the third, it would be a number four.
It would be the first trial, the second trial. First trial was motive was infidelity.
Okay.
Second trial, which is what they were just talking about, the appeals process for.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha. I'm there.
So the third trial started August of 2013. This go around, the prosecution said that David's motive was the life insurance policy on Kim Cam. So the inmate that, and I just want to say real quick, I work in medicine.
Mm-hmm.
So my job and things about medicine come up a lot when I'm just having conversations with friends.
Okay.
Okay. When I'm with family or whatever, they'll be like, hey, Bev, you work with doctors.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. What's this? What do you think about this or whatever?
Yeah.
Kim worked for an insurance company.
Okay.
And if you've ever worked retail, you know you buy from the store that you work at.
Right.
Pretty frequently.
Yeah.
You and I have worked together. We bought from our store a lot.
A lot.
So Kim, being in insurance, probably would have thought, you know what? We need to increase our life insurance.
Yeah.
Kim was aware of the life insurance. She signed off on it.
Yeah.
David also had an increase in his life insurance.
What, like he just increased theirs or something like that.
Anyway, okay. So I just wanted to put that out there because people, you know, you work with police. People ask you legal questions. You're not a lawyer. You don't know.
Absolutely.
But they're going to ask you.
Yeah.
You know. So I'm just saying you end up focusing on your own work and the stuff that you sell or that you deal with on a regular basis usually becomes of interest to you.
Right.
And when it comes to insurance, you're going to be thinking, you know, insurance is a good thing to have. Maybe we need more.
Okay. Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know if the policy was increased before he left the state police. But if it was, that makes sense because he was in a dangerous profession.
Right.
So anyway. Okay. So on to the third trial.
Okay.
The inmate that testified against him in 2006, Jeremy Bullock, that said that he was, that he had confessed while he was getting a tattoo. He went to testify again. This time he was out on parole because he originally was supposed to be in prison for 18 years, but he was on parole. So in cross-examination, Cam's defense attorney, which his name is Richard Kamen, which is going to be kind of confusing.
Interesting. Okay. Uh-huh.
K-A-M-M-E-N.
Richard and Cam. There we go. Richard's the lawyer.
Yeah.
Okay. The defense.
So Kamen, I've been trying to call David, but.
Okay. I like
so
that. Yeah, let's go.
Kamen is the lawyer. He questioned Bullock about why he had come forward after Cam's original trial and conviction. And, of course, Bullock kind of knew where he was going with this, and he said that he denied that he was given any kind of special privilege for testimony, like a reduced sentence or a move to a different prison.
Mm-hmm.
He said, they didn't offer me anything for my testimony. I just told them what happened. I agreed to testify. Basically, out of the goodness of his heart.
Wow.
So, but Kamen noted that everything that Bullock had told them about the crimes and the motives were things that were in the media.
Uh-huh.
Rather than through, you know, this alleged jailhouse confession.
Right.
He's like, everything that you picked up about the motive, about what happened to them, you could have heard.
Like public
and
knowledge.
Newspapers, news, TV, yeah.
Yeah.
And he pointed out, in previous depositions, Bullock had said that he'd watched the CBS 48-hour show about the crime and had told other inmates something along the lines of, fuck that cop, I'm going home. I'll say whatever I need to say to go home.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I've read it one way that way. Another one just said, I'm going to get that cop, or something like that. So it was somewhere in that vein.
Mm-hmm.
Was he saw this show and was like,
haha. His way out.
Yeah, like, I know a way to get to him. Bullock continued to deny the accusations that he'd fabricated the story or that he'd asked for anything in exchange for testifying. But Kamen showed him a petition to modify his sentence that was presented or written by the Johnson County prosecutor. And it mentioned that Bullock had cooperated with the state in testifying in David's 2006 trial. So they said, hey, he cooperated. Let's modify his sentence. Bullock still denied that he'd made a deal. But it turns out, 2 weeks after his testimony in the second trial, Bullock was moved to the Indiana State Prison Farm, which was medium security, and it was like an hour from where his family lived. David's attorney
suspish.
Yeah, right. Totally sus. So David's attorney told him, and I thought this was funny, he said, well, you must have a good luck fairy then. So the prosecution also called in the physicians that had performed the autopsies on the victims. Kentucky's chief medical examiner, Dr. Tracy Corey, testified once again in Cam's third trial. She had performed the autopsies on Brad and Jill.
Okay.
She was the one that had said that Jill had this blunt force trauma and that possibly
what it could have been caused.
It could
from.
Have been straddle fall, it could have been abuse.
Okay.
So because of the previous stuff about the molestation and then it shouldn't have been allowed, she could only testify about basically the gunshot wound and any bruises and stuff on the upper half, like on her arms and shoulders, you know, okay. Upper half of her body.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is where I describe some of the injuries a little bit. So anybody who needs to skip forward, this would be the time. So she described the injuries above the waist, explained that Jill had powder debris on her head, indicating she'd been shot at close range. She told the jurors that the way Brad had died, his spinal cord having been severed by the bullet, he would have been conscious, but paralyzed. He would not have been able to move his legs. So, like I said before, it looked like he was trying to climb over the seat to get in the back to hide when he got shot. So, apparently, he would have started to climb over. He got shot. It severed his spinal cord. His legs wouldn't have moved anymore. And he would have been conscious until he lost enough blood to basically pass out and then pass away.
That's horrific.
Yeah. And they said that based on the evidence, both sides of his face, and I'm not sure if, I think it was, like gunshot residue. Well, he had gunshot residue on both sides of his face. They said that he was likely looking at the muzzle of the gun when he was shot. So I guess he had turned and they shot, shot him in the left shoulder, but I guess he turned to look, probably scrambling over the seat to look and get away. So he saw the shot that killed him. That's so sad. He was 7 years old. It appeared that he was shot from a little bit further away than his sister, because the gunshot residue was present, but not nearly as dense as or as packed as it was on Jill.
Uh-huh.
Then they heard from Dr. Donna Stewart, who had performed Kim's autopsy. She explained that Kim had a single gunshot at a slightly downward angle into her head. She could not determine the range, but she did not have any residue on her. So they can tell if it's close range because there's residue, but once it gets away, far enough away that there's no residue, they can't tell if it was
exactly
5 feet, 10 feet, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So she testified that Kim, when she was brought in from the crime scene, she was wearing a top and underwear, but no pants or shoes. She described a few bruises, some abrasions, and a blood smear above the waistband of her underwear. And she had injuries on both front and back. But there was no evidence of sexual assault. She also had bruising to her toes and abrasions on her chin, elbow, and left foot, which may have happened in a struggle with the killer. Kim's body had been on the floor on the passenger side of her vehicle, which indicates that she was shot while standing there or near there. So I'm wondering if she'd gotten out and come around the vehicle to get Jill, or, you know,
because
she was in a safety seat, like a booster seat or something at that point. So I'm wondering if maybe she walked around the Bronco and Bonet came in from the side of the garage then, maybe. So that's where they found her, was on the passenger side. And I believe that his palm print was on the passenger side. So when, so that was the autopsy reports. And again, they did not mention anything about molestation because they were not allowed to. When the defense team's turn came to begin their case, on September 24th, 2013, they called their first witness, which was the blood spatter expert from David's first trial.
Okay.
So if you remember back in that first trial, the prosecutors had their blood spatter expert testify that the blood on David's shirt was indicative of high velocity blood spatter or blowback from a gunshot.
Right.
Robert Stites was the prosecution's expert.
Okay.
This time, he was testifying for the defense.
What?
So, Stites was a former police officer that was hired by a forensic blood expert named Rod Englert because Englert had not been available on the night of the crime. So, Stites had been hired to take photos and notes at the Cam family crime scene, and he had jumped on a red-eye flight from Portland, Oregon on the night of the murder. He took photos, made notes, and commented that the blood on David's shirt and shoes looked like high-velocity blood spatter. He also marked about 20 areas on the garage door that he believed were blood spatter, but he did not test them for blood. In his notes, he surmised that bleach had been used to clean up blood at the scene. So this information, along with Stites, spoiler alert, supposed credentials, were on the probable cause affidavit that led to David Cam's arrest. In fact, most of the probable cause affidavit was taken from Stites' notes after he talked to Stan Faith, the original prosecutor, and the original detective on the case, Robert Neal. Stites had testified previously that he was a bloodstain pattern analyst and a crime scene reconstructionist. He had also said he was working on 2 doctorate degrees. In the third trial, he admitted that he had flunked basic college chemistry and had never taken physics. He hadn't taken any graduate level courses since 1990. So those 2 doctoral degrees he was working on was bull.
Which is lies.
Yes. Along with falsely stating his credentials, he had also never investigated a murder scene as either a police officer or while working for Rod Englert. He testified that he used a macro lens on his camera and a magnifying glass at the crime scene to analyze the evidence. He did not use a microscope. The blood stains, quote unquote blood stains, on the garage door were later found to be a petroleum-based product. And he also admitted that he had not smelled bleach at the scene, despite making notes that he believed the scene had been cleaned up by the strong-ass smelling bleach.
What in the world? What is going on?
So, they had found a mop bucket and stuff in a sink. So, I'm wondering if he saw that and was like, oh, he tried to clean up the crime scene with bleach. But he never smelled bleach. And anybody who's ever been around bleach, which is almost the entire world, probably, knows how strong it smells.
Yeah.
So, Robert Neal, the original investigator, had once asked Stites how sure he was about the blood evidence. And Stites testified that he had told Neal that it, quote, had those characteristics. The characteristics of high velocity blood spatter.
But that's not even an answer.
Not exactly a ringing endorsement, right?
Yeah.
Of how certain he was. So he also stated that, he said that Rod Englert agreed with his findings, though, because of the size and distribution of the droplets. But Englert didn't see the crime scene. He saw the photos and read his notes. So Robert Stites told the jury in the third trial that at first Englert had complimented him for his work, but later admonished him. Stites said, quote, I was talking too much. So I guess Englert was like, hey man, thanks for doing a great job and helping me out. And then later he's like, shut up. It's like, you're talking about all this stuff you don't know anything about.
So question.
Yes.
Was he even qualified at all?
No.
To be that person?
No.
Like, why would
he had been a he had been a police officer, but only for a couple of years. So he was not a detective. He was not forensics. No. He was a photographer and a note taker. Because Englert wasn't there.
And couldn't be there. This is who Englert's like, oh, I'm gonna get old boy to come out here and take care of this since I can't.
Which, I mean, he could have just taken the pictures and been like, in his notes, okay, there's like, you know, photo of suspect's shirt and shoes.
Right.
Blood present.
Uh-huh.
Photo of garage door, dark stains present. You know, like, he could have put generalized notes.
Which is what you're supposed to do.
Or even, like, measured something. Like, oh, these blood, the dark spots on the door are this big, or whatever. And he could have said, I found a mop and a bucket in the sink. But he, you know, like, putting his own spin on it and commenting on it like he knew what he was talking about.
When you're just looking at evidence.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that.
Yes.
Okay.
So I don't know why he wasn't charged for perjury.
Yeah.
But if he was, I couldn't find anything that said he was punished for it, that he was ever charged with anything.
Wow.
So I don't know. Maybe because he came back in the third, like, into the defense on the third trial and admitted that he was a liar, liar, pants on fire. Maybe they had, I don't know, maybe they made some kind of deal with him. I don't know what it was. Maybe it just wasn't important enough for the media to cover. because the media pretty much thought David Cain was guilty, so.
Yeah.
Anyway, so the defense had one last big objection before the case wrapped up. The jury instructions included language that David could be convicted if the jury felt that he had aided and abetted Charles Bonnet. The defense team's objection was that David had been tried for conspiracy in a second trial and was not convicted of conspiracy. That charge was dismissed. So if
double jeopardy,
if the jury was told, if you think he aided and abetted and you convict him for that, because of that, that's double jeopardy.
Yeah.
That charge was dismissed. Not overturned, it was dismissed in the original trial, so it's double jeopardy.
Right.
But the judge allowed it anyway.
Who are these freaking people?
Right. But it turned out it didn't matter. Richard Kamen, the one of David's lawyers, said that the jury was smart and saw through that. So on October 14th, 2013, the jury acquitted David Cam for the murders of his wife and children.
Hallelujah.
So, not guilty. He was processed out through the jail and released at 1:45 p.m. and then was taken, uncuffed after 13 years, to a rest stop on the interstate. And there he was handed over to his family, including his sister, brother, and father. Kim's parents, Frank and Janice Wren, were in the courtroom when the verdict was handed down. And according to their family lawyer, Nick Stein, Frank Wren sat in silence after the verdict and, quote, he didn't move for 20 minutes. He said the family was expecting the not guilty verdict because, he said, one full day of deliberations was not enough to send a man away for the rest of his life. So apparently, I thought I read somewhere that the jury deliberated for like 19 hours, but I couldn't find it again after I thought I'd read that, so... Uh-huh. But he said one full day of deliberations was not enough to send a man away for the rest of his life. So when the jury came back, they were like, it's not guilty. They were expecting that he was going to be acquitted because the jury wasn't gone long enough, according to them.
Wow.
So Frank and Janice Wren left the courtroom through the back to avoid the media. They ended up dropping their wrongful death suit against David Cam, but not because they believe he's innocent. They still believe he had a hand in killing the kids and killing their daughter and the grandchildren, but they dropped the suit to focus on their other fight, which is to make sure that David Cam does not get his hands on Kim's life insurance money. So they're fighting that. They also had his name removed from the family burial plot because it had both him and her and then the two kids.
Yeah.
And his name was removed. David Cam's three trials knocked the county court budget for a loop. The three trials cost the county $4.5 million in taxpayer money. David, meanwhile, filed lawsuits against several people and entities.
Uh-huh.
Floyd County settled with him for $450,000. The case against the other defendants, which included Stan Faith, the original prosecutor, Robert Stites, the big liar, pants on fire, and Rod Englert, was dismissed in January 2018, but reinstated in 2019 by the Seventh Circuit Court, Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. So they at first said, the lawsuit against these people... We're throwing it out.
Evidence for you to even proceed.
But then the Court of Appeals was like, nah, we're bringing it back. We're bringing it all back.
You're getting a little taste of their own medicine.
Exactly. So the state of Indiana settled for $4.6 million.
Whoa.
For its part. As part of the settlement, Robert Stites released a statement that said he, quote, acknowledges and regrets that his actions in October 2000 as well as the actions of others, contributed to the imprisonment of David Cam, who later was exonerated, end quote. So, I don't know how much he got from the other defendants.
Yeah.
I don't know if just the ones I mentioned were the only ones included. Those were the only names I saw.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph Henderson, which was the second prosecutor that had the book deal, I don't know if he was included in that. I don't see why he wouldn't be.
Yeah.
But those were the names that I saw that I'm pretty sure he sued. And I don't know what he got out of it. But obviously they came to a settlement because part of that settlement, I guess, was Robert Stites saying, I screwed up and other people screwed up and we're the reason why he went to prison. So, David Kam also filed a wrongful death suit against Charles Bonnet, who is serving 225-year sentence for his trial from his trial back in 2006 because he was convicted. So he got sentenced to 225 years. So he filed, David Kam filed the lawsuit against him for wrongful death. And in August 2023, he was awarded three $1 million judgments, so $1 million for each of his three family members, to be paid by Charles Bonnet, who's going to be in prison for the rest of his life, so let's be honest. So the money's he's never going to see the money, but it's kind of a, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So David Kam has been free for 12 years now, which is almost as long as he was in prison.
That is crazy.
But opinions about his guilt or innocence are still divided. Some people believed he was guilty and think he got away with it. Some believed he was guilty at first and changed their minds. Some people always thought he was innocent and railroaded. His family always believed he was innocent and said that the fact that he knew he didn't do it is what got him through prison for 13 years. David now works for Investigating Innocence, and their mission statement says, in part, quote, Investigating Innocence is a not-for-profit organization that provides investigative support to indigent inmates, lawyers, and innocence projects throughout the United States who seek to prove post-conviction claims of actual innocence. So now he actually investigates for this nonprofit organization that helps try to exonerate people who were falsely imprisoned.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's basically the entire story. David Kam arrested, court, trial, convicted, overturned, court, trial, convicted, overturned, court, trial, exonerated.
Oh my gosh.
And Charles Bonnet, who really had the only physical evidence against him, his DNA on a sweatshirt, the sweatshirt that literally had his nickname written in it.
I know, that's what I...
A palm print, the shoes. Like, Charles Bonnet said that the shoes, that David told him to come in and help him afterward. His story changed a million times, by the way. Because at first he said he didn't even know the dude. Okay.
I mean, that's a red flag right there.
Yeah.
Changes it. Like,
exactly.
That's,
yeah.
Come on.
So he said that he went in and almost tripped over her shoes. So he picked him up and sat him on top of the Bronco so nobody else would trip. I'm like, oh, really? What about the bodies on the ground, Dingleberry? Like, what are you...
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So obviously this guy is not super smart.
Makes my head hurt.
And I did read somewhere, I didn't put this in here because the dude's a doof, but that he basically, like, now that he's in prison, he recognizes what he did wrong, even though he still says he didn't actually kill them. But he's where he deserves to be because he'd been a bad person for a long time. And it's like, yeah, you deserve 225-year sentence because you killed a woman and two small children.
Yeah.
For what?
Yeah.
Probably for her shoes.
Well, that's the thing. I'm like, why?
Well, and then also, I had either seen on a video or read somewhere, because there were so many different articles and stuff that I read, and I couldn't find the information again, but his sister or somebody, Bonnet's sister or somebody, worked or owned like a deli or meat shop or something. And it was where Kim and the kids would go to get groceries or whatever it was. Like, it was a place that Kim had been to on a fairly regular basis.
Okay.
So, some people think that he saw her there and targeted her. So
he did live in that area?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think he lived where they live specifically, but
right. They
actually lived on Lockhart Road, which David Kam's uncle was Sam Lockhart. So it's like a family thing. I think it's like maybe a private road.
Oh, okay.
Because like his grandparents lived across the street.
Yeah,
he ran over to them and told them what was going on.
Their family has that street.
Yeah, yeah. So, But I think that that's probably because Bonet didn't really know him, I don't think. I don't think he knew him at all. I think he saw her at that store and followed her. Maybe not that night, but maybe previously.
Right.
Allegedly. Because
a schedule that they followed weekly.
Yeah. Yeah, she had a routine.
And so did David.
Yeah.
So Bonet could figure out that Dad's not going to be there.
Exactly. Yeah, because he was this get together with the friends of the church. Mm-hmm. I think it was the church they went to. And it was a regular thing, like a weekly basketball game. So, like, if Kim had been in there one Wednesday or whatever day it was of the week and said, yeah, my husband plays basketballs on Wednesday, so it's just me and the kids tonight. You know how people just chat with a cashier or whoever? It's possible he heard that. And he decided that night he was going to go, and he had a foot thing, so he was going to, maybe he was going to take her shoes and rape her and then realize the kids were still in the car.
Right.
I don't know. But,
well, and here's the thing. For her to be on the passenger side outside of the car is where they found her body.
Right.
Were her shoes on that
part? I think they were on the driver's side, I think.
That's weird.
Yeah. I saw a picture of them.
So Brad.
And in my head, it was on the driver's side, unless she had backed in, but I don't think she backed in. I think she pulled straight in. So I think it was on the driver's side. So it's possible that she ended up on the passenger side fighting him.
Right.
Running from him or something. Who knows? But maybe he picked him up because Brad was on the passenger side, I think, too. And that's where David had gotten him out. But that's where he laid him down was near where Charles Bonet's sweatshirt was. And so maybe he came around there, like he chased her around the car. Maybe he came in the garage when she was first in there. He ended up taking her shoes off and putting them up on there. I don't know. It was hard to tell because nobody is very specific, and I couldn't find the court documents.
In his shoes?
I don't think. Because that would kind of
tell you if she possibly was wearing them at the time.
But she had injuries to her feet, including like abrasions.
That's true.
So her shoes apparently were off. That's maybe true. He held the gun
and was like,
to her.
Take your shoes off.
Yeah.
Take
and then
pants
she ended
off.
Up fighting him and running, and then he shot
her.
Well,
and then for her to have her pants off.
Yeah. Maybe he was going to rape her and thought that he heard somebody pull in the driveway, or
maybe she seriously started fighting back right then
maybe.
And got that far or something.
Yeah. And
oh
then
gosh,
he shot her and
so
was just
many
like, yeah.
Maybes.
Yeah.
And stuff.
But
like
basically
this.
What it comes down to, I'm not going to say I 100% believe David Kam is innocent.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there is no evidence that he did
really
this.
That really supports that he did it.
Yeah. The only physical evidence that's there says Charles Bonet was there. And he was. It was his DNA. It was his palm print. It was his sweatshirt with his name in it.
Was his sweatshirt just, like, laying on the floor? Was it folded on the floor?
I think they said it was folded neatly on the floor.
That's so weird.
Yeah.
Was that something that he did in his other things?
I don't know.
I wonder if that's
maybe he had
MO.
Taken it off and folded it and laid it there and was waiting for her to come in the garage.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Took it off because he didn't want to get blood on it.
Maybe. Don't know. But
wow.
Yeah, so I think that one of the things that makes me think that David Kam really is innocent is because there was a book written about this by a former FBI agent,
okay.
Gary Dunn.
Okay.
And Gary Dunn said in an article I was reading, said that he, when they first asked him to look into it, he declined to do so because he had actually been a member of the Indiana State Police at one point.
Oh.
So he didn't want to go into a case that they had investigated.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I respect
well,
that.
Well, later on, he decided, okay, yeah, I'm going to look into it.
Mm-hmm.
And he said going into it, he thought, okay, I'm going to follow the evidence, but I'm going to end up finding that he was in that garage and he pulled the trigger.
That David did?
That David did.
Okay.
So he believed David was guilty, but
he went to the evidence
and was following the evidence. Was like, okay, if he did it, the evidence is going to lead me there. So, and that's what I'm going to end up finding. But he actually followed the evidence And when he got done, he was like, holy shit, he did not do this. He named his book Their Bloody Lies and the Persecution of David Cam.
Oh, wow. That's not a statement.
Yeah. I'm like, that pretty much says it all. He's like, they lied. They, like, I think Stan Faith, the original prosecutor, I think knew that Robert Stites didn't have the credentials. So he knew he lied on the stand about his credentials.
It's like some backwoods.
So everybody basically was like, oh, we're going to get this dude. And that's what they did.
That's so, it's like a daggone movie.
Yeah.
Like, I'm literally, like, thinking of so many different movies in my head right now.
Yeah. I'm surprised that a movie hasn't been made about it. Because this happened in 2000, so it's 25 years old now.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Little Brad was 7. He'd be 32 now.
That's...
And then Jill was a couple years behind him. Like, they would have been long graduated high school, college, been had their own kids and everything.
Oh, man.
Yeah. I don't understand, and I don't think that, because Kim had actually told other family members and stuff when they got back together that David had become a great dad.
Uh-huh.
Like, he was dedicated to his kids. He took all the time that he had to play with his kids and to be there for them. So I think even if he desperately wanted to cheat on her, I don't think that he molested his daughter. There was no evidence of that, and I just don't see it.
Yeah.
But even if he had, I don't see him killing the children.
Yeah.
He is a former police officer, or state trooper, so if he was going to try to get her life insurance money, or if he was mad because she was going to confront him, or he wanted to have affairs, he could have killed her in a way that the kids didn't know it happened.
And wouldn't have been involved at all.
Yeah. And he wouldn't have had to kill his children.
Yeah.
So he could have killed her and gotten life insurance money, gotten away with having affairs, and gotten away with molesting his daughter if he did that. Why would you do it where you had to kill your children too because they were witnesses?
It's weird. That doesn't make any sense. No.
It's like, he could have come up with a way. He could have waited till the kids went inside and then killed her, or waited till they were in bed and said somebody broke in, or, you know, like, the same kind of crap that all spouses do that end up getting caught. But if they thought that he was that good and that he could cover it all up because of his experience as a state trooper, he could have come up with a better plan than this.
For sure. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That he wouldn't have had to kill his children unless he didn't love his children, but had people fooled.
And everybody, yeah. I mean, he would have had to, like I said, he would have had to have been the perfect actor because everybody was like, he loves his kids.
Too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, I mean, I guess that can happen and probably has, but
yeah. It
doesn't seem. But also with him being law enforcement, yes, he might know the ins and outs of how to get by with it. One, nobody's perfect.
Right. Well, and there have been other law enforcement, you know, current law enforcement officers who have killed their spouse or whatever and have not gotten away with it.
Right.
Because it's hard to fake some of this stuff.
Right. Well, and you were talking about just his call to his former...
Yeah, his post, yeah.
His post. Mm-hmm. And how, like, gut-wrenching and desperate honest he sounded.
Yeah.
It was not...
Yeah, it gave me chills. I was just like, oh my god, you could hear the pain.
Well, and especially for a law enforcement officer, they are, I know it's his family, but they are...
They're trained to be objective and
they put
and
their
to detach.
In, yes, in that little box to get through what they have to.
Yeah.
I find it hard that he would have been, like, freaking out and whatever
if he didn't actually feel it.
Done it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I guess I can't say with 100% that I don't think he did it, but I
kind of don't think
he did.
Yeah, yeah. And I was, like, more doubting it, like I said, until I read the article about the former FBI agent Gary Dunn that wrote the book.
Yeah.
And how he went into it thinking that David Cam
was
guilty.
Find
yeah.
It, yeah.
And then he named his book what he named it. Their Bloody Lies and the Persecution of David Cam.
Well, and the fact that you also have...
Which I would like to read, but I haven't bought a copy of it or anything yet, so...
I'm sure you can find it out there somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's out there. I just have to purchase it.
But also, because you have Bonet, mm-hmm. and it's like, yeah, he's also, like, the perfect...
Yeah.
What am I trying to say? Like, person to fit everything.
Like, the profile. Yeah, he fits.
Like,
yeah.
It makes sense.
Yeah. Because there was the chance that he did know Kim from that store, whatever it was that...
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly. The chance that he knew who she was. David Cam maintained forever that he did not know this dude.
Right.
Charles Bonet himself, at first, said, I don't know him.
Yeah.
And then basically, what I read one place was they told him, we've got you. Your best chance is to be a witness. So it was like they told him, hey, we can place you at the scene. Your best opportunity here is to be a witness against David Cam.
Dude, they had to have like...
So they basically told him, this is what we want to do. Like, they like, basically were like, hey...
They hated David, and that's weird.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know.
Like, it seems completely obvious now that... They were blatantly trying to find anything.
It's basically what some people say is basically that they thought that he did it. And I appreciate in one way the fact that they would even entertain the idea.
Right.
Because, you know, the thin blue line, there was a chance that they would always, you know, because cops have gotten away with shit because their department would cover it up for them.
True.
So I appreciate the fact that they were like, instead of saying, well, he's one of ours or used to be, you know, they looked at him. They should have.
Yeah.
That's completely fine.
But when there's
it's like
no
they got the idea
found.
And then that the fake expert told them that it was blood spatter. And so they were like, okay. And then they didn't want to admit that they were wrong. Yeah. That's what I feel like happened.
Especially for one
and the prosecutor got in it and was like, yeah, don't admit that you're wrong. We got this.
It just blows my mind how ruthless and like laser focused those two prosecutors were on David.
Yeah. When I first started reading about this, and our sister-in-law is actually the one that brought this case up to me. So when I dove into it and everything, mm-hmm. when they came across the sweatshirt and they ran it through CODIS again, which they had to force the prosecution to
like,
do.
That alone is like, what?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's like, if you really think he's guilty, then why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you check?
Because you would be like, yeah.
Because then it would
be
a slam dunk. Yeah. Anyway, so when the thing about Charles Bonet popped up and then his palm print matched and whatever, I was like, okay.
Like,
except then I was like, wait, but I know he has three trials. Because that's one of the first things that you see is that he was convicted twice and whatever.
And the fact that it kept going when there's physical evidence linking someone else there. Like, I know the prosecution was like, oh, well, he got Bonet to do it then. They're doing it together for that second trial.
Yeah.
But it's like
everybody, juries, everybody wants there to be DNA and a palm print in their case.
Right. And it literally was.
Yes.
And they couldn't prove that there was ever collusion between the two of them.
Yeah.
That's another thing. Like, they should be required to show.
Yeah.
How did they meet up? How did they get the information? Yeah. Like, show us.
Yeah. Bonet said that they met playing basketball at a park. And then he met up with David at that store that Kim went to. And that's where they talked about what the plan was. And David asked him, that's where they met up when David wanted him to sell him a gun. He came to him to ask for a gun.
I guess there's no surveillance, huh? No surveillance at the store?
But it doesn't matter anyway because it's bullshit.
Exactly. Well, that's what I'm saying. It'll show that there was never anything.
And then also, through all this, this is one of the issues that people have been pointing out about blood spatter evidence.
Mm-hmm.
You can see in a crime scene if, you know, like, okay, somebody's laying there, their head, they've been bludgeoned, there's a hammer that's bloody next to them, there's blood on the wall and an arc
and the
you can say
hanger.
That blood spatter evidence is likely from that hammer. Okay,
and that makes sense.
Yeah,
right.
But just out of context, looking at a drop of blood, you can't tell exactly what happened.
No, that's crazy.
They're like, it's subjective, because obviously you have experts on the defense side and experts on the prosecutor side, aside from the ones that pretend to be experts and aren't, but they actually are experts.
They should come to the same
conclusion. And they should, if it was objective and scientific, but it's right. junk science.
Right.
And that's what they're discovering, is that it's junk science.
That's sad.
And, you know, like I said, if it's obvious that, you know, like, okay, yeah, they swung it above their head.
Right.
And hit them with a hammer. Okay. Yeah, you see the blood spatter on the wall. You see it on the ceiling. It makes sense. And it lines up with everything there. But, like, his shirt having a few drops of blood on it, there is no way that you can look at that and say definitively, this is what happened. And this is why those things were there.
He was making the evidence fit the story he thought.
Exactly.
Instead of following the evidence to the story.
Right.
And that is basically what you always see as far as, like, crooked
police departments and stuff. Yeah.
And whatever.
Yeah.
But also, like, I can't help but think about movies I've seen where...
Right.
You know...
And TV shows, Law and Order, how many times this...
Oh my gosh.
Things like that happen.
Like, every episode.
Yeah.
Or whatever. Yeah. Anything like that. So that's the main thing. Like,
yeah, it's like they came up with the story team. And they decided that any evidence, like the evidence that Charles Bonnet was there, they just were like, okay, well, we'll just change our theory of what happened then.
Yeah.
And still go with it.
And the fact that David had blood on his shirt. Okay. Yeah, he had blood on his shirt.
Yeah. And he had blood on his shoes, but that was probably just transfer where he brushed against things that were bloody.
That and address that. But it's like, you can't say that it's blowback from
the
high velocity
impact spatter or whatever. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
But like,
and it was just his daughter's.
Right.
And it's like, well, he shot his son at close enough range that his son had gunshot residue on him, so wouldn't he have had spray from that too?
Ooh, at least a little bit.
But no, it's because he reached over his daughter. That's why it was only her blood.
That's crazy. Oh my gosh. And then for him to spend, 13 years?
Yeah.
13 years trying to prove his innocence.
Yeah.
And people just... And then for her family.
Yeah, and I feel for her family because...
Yeah, and I don't want to say anything bad about them.
Yeah, no,
I can't imagine being in that position.
Yeah, there were only grandchildren, were Brad and Jill. And,
was that their only daughter or child?
I don't know.
Either way, it's still...
I'm not sure. I couldn't find a lot about her background because it all just went straight to,
right.
You know, her murder.
Yeah.
Like, nobody wants to talk about the victim's background. But anyway. But I feel for them because if they feel like he did it, then to them, he's getting away with it.
Yeah, that would be heartbreaking.
Yeah, and... They probably only know what the prosecutor's office told them.
Yeah.
And so they probably have it in their head that they had evidence against him. And eventually
they just
nitpicked and stuff until the appeals court overturned his two convictions. And then the last jury just believed him, you know, and stuff like that. And so I feel for them. They lost their daughter and she was young.
Yeah.
She was 35.
Yeah.
And they lost their only two grandchildren.
Yeah.
And they were just babies.
And a son-in-law.
Yeah, and a son-in-law.
Like, because they did believe him at first,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right.
And it sounds like once the prosecution got a hold of them, most likely.
And I mean, and sure, he probably wasn't a great husband. He cheated on her.
And having that,
yeah,
obviously they're going to be a little bit more biased towards him because of that.
Right.
But...
And that's fine in a personal opinion, but in a trial, it can't be part of the problem.
Exactly.
Unless, like I said, there's some evidence.
Yeah, that would be a really hard place to be.
But, yeah. So I feel for them because I'm glad that Charles Bonnet is at least serving time for it because I really think that he did kill them.
I agree.
I don't know the exact story. We probably never will because he will never be honest about
it. He's never going to be honest. Yeah.
So at least justice has been served as far as, you know... people think, but then along with the Wren family, there are a lot of people who don't think that justice was served, and they think that David Cam was, yeah,
ultimately getting away with
right.
it.
Right. So, I don't know, and I'm not here to judge that. Like I said, my opinion is that he likely did not do it.
Right, I agree.
Now, if he hired Charles Bonnet, I guess I couldn't find anything that said that they found any money that Charles Bonnet had or that he was promised or anything. So, I don't know.
And honestly, the prosecution was so sneaky and conniving.
Yeah.
Even if David did end up knowing Bonnet and they had planned that, like,
yeah, as shifty as they were. Yeah, exactly. It's like, if y'all had just followed the evidence and it led to him, great.
Right, we can't argue with that. Yeah,
but now it's like, now we wouldn't trust you with anything, with any evidence, because of all the shifty stuff you pulled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly, I agree.
So, anyway, that was the Cam family murder. And that was a tough one. Just because of the little kids, and Kim was, you know, a good mom and a good person, and I feel for her parents so much. I hope that David Cam is, you know, I hope he is actually innocent, and I hope that he's having a good life, and that he can carry on and have that not be his entire life.
Right.
In a way, he was lucky he only served 13 years, because there are people who have served 20 or 30 years.
Well, his wife before they were exonerated got a life sentence.
Yeah.
And that's what other people will say, but
yeah,
I still have a hard time believing that he did it.
Yeah, but I mean, even the people, other people that have been come back later and been found innocent had served 20 or 30 years in prison, you know. So he was lucky that it was only 13, you know, only. And hopefully he's in a job now, if he's still with Investigating Innocence. The last thing I saw was like 2022, I think, or something. So it could have been that he's changed by now, but if he is still with it, then hopefully he's helping other families that have loved ones that they don't think did it, that are in prison. And
he's getting to an age where he might retire or whatever, too.
Yeah, yeah. True.
Because he was in law enforcement and everything before.
Yeah. Okay, so there's the Cam family murder.
Have mercy.
Yeah, we will be back next week. Our email address is triggerwarning411@gmail.com. So you can send us an email that says that you love us dearly. And you can, and if you have any case suggestions, true crime, survival, disasters.
I mean, anything really.
Spooky. If you want to tell us spooky stuff, that's cool. And just email us. So triggerwarning411@gmail.com. And we'll see you next Wednesday, I reckon.
See you guys next Wednesday.
Bye-bye.
Watch for deer.
Bye.